This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, why are Kenyan farmers opposed to a government plan to vaccinate their livestock, even though experts say it's to their benefit? And she blazed a trail on stages worldwide, but now she is no more. We celebrate the legacy of Dada Masilo, the young South African dancer who died suddenly just over a week ago.
Yeah, is a dance maker, creator, choreographer, artist, who really made sure that all the stories are told with integrity, but then it's on her own terms. And then not forgetting where we come from, because that was so important to her, that we have to tell our stories. And then once we do that, do it with integrity.
It's Monday, the 6th of January, 2025. First, we go to the airspace over the European Union. We are flying high in sometimes not so friendly skies because the EU has banned several African airlines from entering its airspace. The issue is safety in the eyes of the EU, and 55 companies in Africa are on a list due to what the EU considers to be inadequate regulatory oversight by national aviation authorities. The Democratic Republic of Congo seems to be most affected, with all airlines from there being banned. Derek Nseko is the founder of Airspace Africa, a qualified commercial pilot and also founder of iFly Global and iFly Academy, institutions dedicated to encouraging and teaching young people to enter the industry. And he's been telling me interesting details about the other countries on the list and the implications of the ban. I asked Derek if he was surprised by the number of airlines on the list.
I'm not particularly surprised that there's so many African airlines on the list. To be honest with you, I think the number, which is I think 55, does not necessarily tell the whole story, because the 55 actually represent about 11 African countries. To be honest with you, about 35 of those are from three of the same countries. So we're looking at Libya, Sudan, and the DRC, which have about 12, 13, and 10 between them. Yeah, that makes a huge difference.
The majority of them come from three countries. Tells us something about those countries. But what does it tell us about the other countries?
Let me tell you something about those three countries that might actually tell a story of its own. Because if you look at Libya, you look at Sudan, you look at the DRC, and you compare with the fact that the other countries from outside Africa that are largely affected by this list are Iran, are Iraq, are Russia, you know, regions of that type. I think that company tells you a story of its own as well. I think your listeners as well can probably do the math.
No, you do the math for us. We don't want to jump to conclusions. Because what struck me about the African countries is that to a large extent, they are affected by conflict of some sort or the other.
Yes, the countries that are mostly affected are countries that are in regions that have been affected by some form of conflict. We know the story with Libya. It had a war which spiraled into civil war, and they still have issues, especially with their airspace. So that has been a problem for a long time. Then obviously Sudan as well. Sudan had its own civil war. We had the overthrow of a president. The DRC historically has had safety issues. So they've had their issues for a while. So the airlines from the DRC have been affected for a very long time, including the national airline. It's been on this list for a very long time. So most of these are systemic issues in Africa. So the DRC has been affected for a while because of lack of proper compliance with international standards and safety. It's probably the country in Africa with the most aviation incidents.
So just a quick look at the other three countries that you mentioned outside of Africa, Russia, Iran, and Iraq. Are there safety concerns there, or are they of a more political nature, placing them on this list?
The safety concerns there definitely have something that relates to elements of politics. And, the ironic thing as well is that we're talking about Africa, but on the flip side, the continent that has actually been affected by safety in the past 1 year has not been Africa. So if we look at, for example, the latest incidents in international aviation, we had the airline from Azerbaijan We're still waiting for the report from that air incident, but a political issue has something to do with what might have happened with that aircraft. So this always brings up safety concerns. When you have these regions that are plagued by some form of conflict or war, the airspace is an area that is red flagged usually. So you find that airlines will start flying or choosing alternative routes to get to their destination.
Now, last year, African Airlines marked their fourth safe year in a row after registering no fatal accident again in 2023, according to the International Air Transport Association, or IATA, at their annual safety review for 2023. So there were no passenger jet aircraft losses or fatal accidents since 2020. So let's look at the ban from that point of view.
To be honest, I feel in that sense that the ban kind of highlights a disconnect between the operational safety, which is evidenced by IATA statistics, and the actual compliance and regulatory standards and what exactly is on the ground. Because yes, while the EU safety list focuses on systemic issues within airlines or maybe national regulatory authorities that fail to meet the standards that are set by the likes of ICAO and the European Aviation Safety Agency, what is on ground does not always have to reflect that. I think this brings up the point that I just made, that Africa has not been having safety issues. The last incident we had of a jetliner in Africa was actually the Ethiopian crash, the ET-302 that happened in 2019 before the COVID pandemic. And yet on the flip side, some of the regions that are not red flagged by the EU are the regions as well that are facing jet hull losses in the world. For example, like Air Tanzania, the ban stems from maintenance irregularities most likely, and not necessarily always operational shortcomings or oversight issues. So yes, we have to emphasize that with Africa, these don't exactly mean that these are immediate safety threats for passengers that are flying with African Airlines. I think that has to be emphasized. So it demonstrates that even with an excellent safety record, as we are seeing in other regions around the world, you can have lapses in safety as well.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking about the big Boeing issues that we've been looking at over the last few years. Has that affected countries where Boeing failures have been recorded? Have they been placed on any of these lists?
Not necessarily because of Boeing or anything, at least not from an African airline perspective.
No, I meant the countries where it happened. For instance, in America, where you had sort of doors coming off planes and so on. Have those been taken into account and those countries placed on lists as well?
If that was something that came into play, then we would probably have more than half of the world's airlines being banned from flying into Europe, because then you'd have to say there's an issue with the aircraft and there's a safety issue with the aircraft. That means that the aircraft cannot fly. That would honestly just preempt a banning of the actual aircraft and not a banning of the airlines.
I see the difference. So the airlines that have been mentioned, or African airlines in general, do you take them as an African aviation expert living in Kampala?
I can tell you I'm a frequent flyer, and most of my flights are with African Airlines. I've never felt unsafe because I'm flying an African airline. To be honest with you, many of the African airlines are endorsed by IATA. They are certified with IATA's operational safety audit, and they are held to very, very high standards. They face stringent audits, pretty much like what Air Tanzania has faced as well. Airlines like Ethiopian Airlines are widely regarded as one of the best in the world in terms of safety and operational efficiency. With some of the particular airlines that are highlighted in the list, I mean, the key maybe is to research the airline's track record and ensure that they are members of reputable organizations like IATA or ICAO, because some of them are not. But I mean, safety is not always a record of the past. You know, safety is not always a guarantee, at least of the future. In fact, to be honest with you, it can be a record of the past, but it's not a guarantee of the future.
That was Derek Nseko, founder of Airspace Africa and a qualified commercial pilot. Now we are in Kenya, where the government intends to roll out a program to vaccinate millions of animals against livestock diseases. The aim is to meet international standards for meat and leather exports. Around 70 million animals are to be vaccinated starting later this month, if all goes to plan. But farmers, veterinary professionals, and community leaders don't seem to want to play ball. Why? Let's hear from some farmers.
As a dairy farmer in Kenya, I will not be participating in the vaccination campaign. for the following reasons. One, we do not have clear information, so which leaves a lot of questions and also creates a lack of trust. Two, ownership of animals in this country is private, and a lot of resources and investment go into rearing these animals. So when there is a government policy that states that there is a vaccination campaign that is being planned that seems rushed and the outcomes are not clear, it leaves a lot to be desired, because nobody who has invested in animal farming, dairy farming, whichever kind of farming that one does, is willing to give up their investment without understanding what exactly is in that vaccine.
I'm a livestock farmer, and I will not be taking my animals for vaccination, because always done it through the professional vets. And this time round, I don't understand why the government is coming in to do this. We've not had any outbreaks. We've consulted with our vets. They are saying there are no outbreaks, but they are also waiting to see how the government will be rolling this out. And they will be advising us accordingly. It's not straightforward. There hasn't been proper publicization on it. We will not want to risk our farming businesses to something that we don't know.
So let's dig a bit deeper with Dr. Jeffrey Omondi, a veterinary specialist with experience in managing livestock health in Kenya. We began at the beginning. What are these animals being vaccinated against?
The vaccination, the target was actually two diseases. One disease is called PPR, Pested Hepatitis Ruminans, which is a disease of basically the sheep and goats. But then it's closely related to actually Rinderpest, which was eradicated like a decade plus ago. The other disease is foot and mouth disease, which is a disease that basically does affect cows, sheep, goats, but also does affect pigs, but also does affect wildlife. Both of these diseases are actually diseases that do cause production losses, basically losses that emanate from the whole process of livestock keeping.
So why now, though? Because there seems to be resistance to this campaign. Why?
When you run a campaign, just as we will do in a human vaccination program, there are steps that precede the actual campaign. One of them is community sensitization, where you would assume you want to talk to prominent farmers, community voices, prominent people within the communities, the veterinarians, the animal health professionals, the farmers themselves, who are actually the main stakeholders. So I think there are steps preceding this that need to be accounted for prior to the vaccination campaign. The farmers being the main stakeholders, they need to actually buy in. So the buy-in comes from them having information, them being given reasons as to why these vaccines are necessary, and then most importantly, consent. I think the farmers feel like they have not consented to the vaccination program, and they have not been given a chance to actually for their voices to be heard.
Will they have to pay for it?
They have been discussing various models. One of them is a little payment from the farmers, which both that as a model also has its own challenges, including low uptake.
So why are farmers resisting?
Vaccinations, especially when rolled out en masse like this, they carry political risks. And so the politics of the day also tend to have a bearing on the vaccination campaigns themselves. So what you're seeing here is within the country, Kenya, we have a government that has challenges, especially with communicating to the populace. And so with that in mind, they also have very low approval ratings. So even if it's a good initiative coming from a slightly less popular government, it's viewed from a very different lens. Also, you're seeing a lot of misinformation coming in, where people think the animals are going to be not necessarily vaccinated against PPR and FMD, but potentially so that they are not producing as much methane, which is a greenhouse gas. And so there's a lot of convoluted conversations, which is actually leading to the resistance.
Let's talk about the methane gas emissions and that being controlled. And the president did actually say that one of the reasons why he wanted to roll out this program is to mitigate the effects of climate change. So are people right, perhaps, then to be suspicious?
Those vaccines by themselves control the diseases. Yes, you can argue that controlling diseases makes the animals more efficient, so you may control that, but there are different ways in which we do control the production of methane from these animals. There are a lot of research that has gone into this. Most common one is diet manipulation, but more currently, a lot of research has gone into the use of vaccines to basically produce from the saliva reduce the what we call as methanogenic bacteria, so bacteria that produce methane. So you reduce that, and so you're able to reduce it by maybe 20-22% to something like that. But those particular technologies, especially with the aspect of the vaccination, have not been super successful. And so there's a lot of research going into it. The challenge is not communicating effectively that this particular vaccination drive is geared towards PPR and FMD, not necessarily geared towards reducing the methane production, even though that was mentioned in one of the speeches. I think that is also contributing to the resistance, because with every new technology that comes in, people think you're basically trying to reduce the animal population in Kenya or make them less productive.
But what happens when farmers refuse to vaccinate their animals?
If people don't vaccinate the animals then, and especially with the current climate of misinformation and information challenges, we may see an upsurge in livestock diseases in the country and more production losses. And we can't access certain markets because of sanitary and phytosanitary measures that are put in place by the World Trade Organization. And so vaccination is a way of controlling diseases, but it needs to consider certain things. One is the locality, two is the epidemiology of the disease, three is the risk based on where people or the animals exist.
But you don't think that the government can compel people to have their animals vaccinated? Do you see it happening?
It will be challenging because of the resistance we're seeing from the population. But also the more challenging part of it is we need a lot of doses for, we are looking at 50 million sheep and goats and 22 million cows. That's 72 million animals. That's a lot of doses. And we will need to assess our capacity, both from a production perspective for the vaccines, but also from a human resource capacity perspective. So we will need to change tact to be able to actually achieve some percentages. Vaccinations, generally, you need to vaccinate a certain percent of animals to be able to control the disease. And so not being able to achieve that particular minimum means the efficacy of the vaccine will be compromised.
So do you see the government actually taking on board the caveats that you've mentioned, sensitizing people, making them aware of the reasons why this is necessary, and cajoling them into it rather than coercing them into it?
They might, because some stakeholders have come out and in opposition, and some have come out to basically explain the components. We know through the Director of Veterinary Services, there are ongoing engagement in terms of how can they make this a success. So hopefully it may land on listening ears, and that may allow for potentially a change of tact. But as it stands right now, I think it's going to be challenging.
And even though it's the main source of livelihood to the people in the arid and semi-arid lands, or are these the areas where we won't see resistance? It's in other areas where we'll see resistance.
We may actually see resistance in the arid and semi-arid lands. Those particular communities hold their animals dear because they are not just assets. They are their current accounts. They are their cultural bearings. They are basically a way of lifestyle.
So why would it be difficult to persuade them then that this is for the good of their animals and it's safeguarding their assets?
Persuade is the term I'll use here, where we need to persuade people by providing enough information, but also sensitizing them. In the past, other campaigns have been run through the Directorate of Veterinary Services, where they will go to the ground, identify like the chiefs, some leaders within the community, opinion shapers within the community, to basically mobilize the community, and they provide communication. And I think we need to do that as a way of persuasion. So it cannot be a forced event, explaining the aims of what we come to do and the potential risks involved. Allow the person to be able to digest that information and then provide you with consent.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Omondi, a veterinary specialist in Kenya.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Shh.
She was an entrancing, electrifying presence on stage, a dancer and choreographer who wanted to use her art to, in her own words, open conversations about homophobia and domestic violence because those are issues at home. She turned classical ballets like Swan Lake and Giselle on their heads, and she did this not just in storytelling terms, but also in the form itself. So she would fuse the rigidity of classical ballet with the movements of her culture, which derived from the Tswana people in South Africa. As you listen to the clapping and stamping, imagine a group of 12 dancers in flowing dresses performing a healing rhythmic dance she called The Sacrifice. Dada was 39 when she died in hospital in Johannesburg after a short illness on the 29th of December. Her death is being mourned by colleagues and friends worldwide, her life and contribution celebrated by people like David Tatanello April, who was a friend and mentor. He'd known her since she was a child.
We ended up becoming very, very close, where the relationship went beyond that of a teacher, mentor, and then friendship. So, yeah, she was really, really close to me.
I just want to talk a little bit about her background, you know, the family that she came from, where she came from. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. So she was based in between Soweto, and at the time ended up living with Suzette Le Sœur in town, because when she then went to high school, that's when she then started going to the National School of the Arts. So it was easier for her to be in the suburbs in town, because it would mean that access to the National School of the Arts was easier. During high school years, it was mostly staying in town near the school.
So she began as a street dancer as well in South Africa, as a younger dancer.
Yes, yes, as most of us, because at that time when we were growing up, there was very, very little opportunity in terms of recreation. So we had to entertain ourselves. And then this was even before the advent of TV. I call it the advent of TV because at that time there wasn't necessarily exposure in terms of what was happening out there. So street dance was one of our outlets, basically, to express ourselves as part of our own entertainment. So it was very, very important in the development of young people, actually, throughout South Africa. So it would be different, obviously, in various provinces. But then, yes, that's how we would then entertain ourselves at that time.
But South Africa also has very strong traditional dance traditions, right? And she comes from the Tswana group, and her Swan Lake, I know, for instance, I saw it here in London. She talks a lot about, and also Sacrifice, which I just love. I saw it at the beginning of last year, where she talks about how she's integrating the dancers of her community background, and how she wanted to incorporate also in traditional ballet all these other influences that she brought as a South African. How successful do you think she was in doing that?
Very successful. And then I'm saying very successful in the sense that because her main training was ballet and contemporary dance, and then now she wanted to delve into Tswana dance forms, I then advised her to work with a Tswana dance specialist. His name is Pinky. To really, really go into the research and then to appreciate exactly what it is that she wanted to do in terms of her story, like understanding the nuances, understanding the context of the various Tswana dance forms. And then what ended up happening was obviously infusing all of that with ballet and contemporary, but then with a clear understanding that I am doing this. This is the interpretation in terms of the story. And then that's how then she managed to layer all the other aspects of Sacrifice as part of the overall production. So from that point of view, research was very important to her. She didn't just do movement for movement's sake, but then it was appropriating with understanding and also making sure that whether it was locally or internationally, there is that basic understanding of why is it that she was doing that in the first place.
What was she like? She comes across as this lovely, radiant, very slim figure. but, you know, with a big burning passion inside her.
What we are doing today is we are learning Tswana dance in preparation for my new work. It's called The Sacrifice. So learning Tswana dance so that I can be able to fuse Tswana dance and contemporary dance. Some of the moves from Tswana dance are actually inspired by animals, particularly the meerkat. You know, so when Pinky is teaching us the movement, it's very specific. It's hard, but it's also a lot of fun to learn.
The thing is, before I got to know Dada, she was very, very shy. And then in most instances, people would then think that, oh my goodness, she's but arrogant. Why doesn't she talk to me? Why doesn't she greet me? But then that was just like, you know, her safeguarding herself from all the elements of what could be outside. So shy at the beginning, but then once you get to know her, very, very generous in spirit, very, very bubbly, an incredible sense of humor. So Dada as a person, beyond what we've read about in terms of her accolades and whatnot, she was very, very generous, very loving. And she simply just loved working, especially with young people, children, because that's where she also got that fire and then that inspiration to then say that this is my source, almost like the youngsters would be like her muse in creating, in thinking about all these other narratives that she's put on stage.
I was watching some of her dancing earlier, and some of the ones that I've seen, some that I hadn't seen, and I could always pick her out in the crowd without even seeing her face. You always knew which one was her because she yes. moved in such a particular way. What was it about her style that made her stand out in that way?
Well, Dada was an incredible storyteller. And then the thing is, you are quite right. At once she's on stage, whether it's with 5 people or 10 people or 15, your eye would turn towards her. And then for me, it's all about the way that you will then embody the story, embody the production, because that in itself would be, this is what I'm telling at that moment, and then I want you to be part of that journey. And then because she's had that experience as a performer, it would be that now people are literally drawn to her. So it was also the passion, the way that she used to express herself. Storytelling, she did it with integrity. She didn't cut corners. And once she was on stage, she just became this totally different being until the moment that she takes the bow. And then it would be, oh, okay, now that's it. I'm back to self. So it was just the way that she would interpret the stories that she was telling from ballet, infusing African dance with contemporary dance. So it would be just that beautiful uniqueness about her as a performer.
She died at the age of 39, just a month or so short of her 40th birthday. So it's really difficult to talk about a legacy because she still had so much to do, so far to go. But what would you say she will be remembered for or should be remembered for?
So many things. One, just the passion. I'm like, I know it sounds like a cliche, but then just the passion for telling our story in our own terms and then making sure that, yes, you use all these other tools available to you to make sure that ultimately once somebody from Europe or from the States or from wherever sees that, they're able to see that here is a dance maker, creator, choreographer, artist who really, really made sure that all the stories are told with integrity, but then it's on her own terms. And then not forgetting where we come from, because also, that was so important to her, that we have to tell our stories. And then once we do that, do it with integrity.
And that was David Tatanello April sharing his memories of Dada Masilo, the South African dancer who died at the age of 39. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Wagira Maria and Amy Leibovitz here in London. Susan Gashui brought her end from Nairobi. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Jack Raysmark, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Find us on air, in a podcast, and on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.